From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 172 with guest Adam Mechanic, recorded Monday, August 9th, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio, and today my guest is Adam Mechanic. Adam is a Boston-based independent database consultant, writer, and speaker. He has been involved in dozens of SQL Server implementations, both high-availability OLTP and large-scale database warehouse applications, and has optimized data access layer performance for several data-intensive applications. And he's been published all over the place. He's been on .NET Rocks in the past, but today it's Run As Radio, my friend. How you doing, Adam?
I am well. And you?
Good, good. So I saw this bit you did at PASS about parallelism in SQL Server. And it intrigued me because I've been paying a lot of attention to parallelism lately because there's so many more cores flying around than there used to be.
Yeah, this is an area that I've been especially interested in for the last 6 months or so. Even for the last couple of years, I've just started noticing, you know, as multi-core has started really ramping up and really, you know, the price points have started coming down. We've seen more and more cores in the data center, and I've seen the importance of parallelism just really start to pick up. And then in the last 6 months or so, I don't know what clicked, but all of a sudden I just realized this is the next big thing. We've been focused on I/O for so long.
Yeah, it's always been about disk speed, right?
Right, just I/O, 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 and now all of a sudden I'm seeing, at least in my work, and I've been working on large data warehouses, and I'm just seeing parallelism become paramount in importance, and that's really making a big difference.
Now, me looking around SQL Server, parallelism is pretty much automatic, right? There really wasn't much to do. It was on by default, and if you had more cores, it would use them, right?
Well, yes and no. There are a number of settings that you can configure to make parallelism either work better or not work at all. You can turn it off. Matter of fact, in earlier versions of SQL Server, a lot of people just turned it off. SQL Server 2000. Well, so it was first introduced to the product in SQL Server 7.
Right.
And I don't think many people even knew it was there. First of all, a lot of customers were still running on very, very small servers where it wouldn't even kick in. And when it did kick in SQL Server 7 and SQL Server 2000, the results were often, shall we say, less than ideal.
Yeah, it made things actually slower. And typically all you were doing was taking a query and running it on two cores.
Right.
And the process of splitting it and reassembling it actually netted to a loss.
Yes. So a lot of customers I saw during that time period were actually just disabling the thing altogether. And then in SQL Server 2005, the SQL Server team rewrote the process scheduler that SQL Server uses. It's called the user mode scheduler, UMS. Now it's called SQL Operating System, or SQL OS.
Oh, wow.
So they rewrote the thing from the ground up, and with that, they rewrote the parallelism piece, and now it works much, much better. In SQL Server 2005 and 2008, parallelism, rather than slowing things down, still can slow things down in some cases, but more often than not, it actually speeds them up, and that's why it's getting much more interesting.
And the bigger benefit here now is that, well, Intel just announced they have a 48-core single chip that runs x64, which is pretty staggering. Like, it's just the reality is now 16, 32-way machines are just not that rare anymore. They're quite common. So you can have sort of massive parallelism on a query.
Right, right, right. 48 cores. I actually hadn't seen that. That's amazing.
It's really terrifying. And a photograph of a guy holding a little die that's, you know, maybe 60 millimeters across, but there's 48 cores in that.
So we'll have to see how that impacts the licensing question.
Yeah, it is an interesting problem, isn't it? Because it's technically only one chip. So if we're only being charged per chip, that's a pretty good deal.
Right. Now, in SQL Server 2008 R2, they actually changed things a little bit. Standard edition can only scale up to so many chips now.
Right.
I believe it's 4. If anyone's listening, don't trust me on that. I'm not a licensing expert.
Nobody is, apparently.
So,
but you realize if you were stuck at only 4 chips with that thing, that would mean you were restricted to a mere 192 cores.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Well, and this, when I found setting up 8-way machines on reasonably busy SQL servers, you never had enough cores free for parallelism to really come into play. I mean, I'm just wondering how many cores it's going to take for parallelism to make a huge difference.
Well, it depends on the workload, right?
I guess.
So for an OLTP workload, for like a point of sale system,
mm-hmm.
or an e-commerce website or something like that, you can have a very active OLTP workload, and usually you don't actually want any parallelism in those cases.
I guess this points to what are the kinds of queries that parallel well?
Well, there is overhead.
Right.
There's always overhead. Basically, SQL Server, the query processor, in order to make things go parallel, has to take your data and it has to split it up into smaller chunks, and it has to coordinate those onto different threads,
right,
chunks of data. And then at some point, it has to take all those chunks after they've been processed on each individual thread and then pull them back together into one cohesive piece of data or stream of data. And there's overhead in both of the phases of distribution of the data and then gathering the data back together. So, you know, for a very small set of data, if you're working with 10 rows, let's say,
yeah,
that overhead is far greater than just pulling the data out and processing it on a single thread.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're working with 100 million rows, well, now it's much better to split that up and process it separately.
So this sounds very data warehousey. This is massive aggregation.
Yeah, massive data, but even smaller sets of things, for example, index rebuilds.
Oh, yeah.
So everyone needs to do an index rebuild from time to time,
mm-hmm.
whether you're on an OLTP system, whether you're on a large data warehouse, you have to do some index maintenance. And in SQL Server 2005 and 2008, index processes can take advantage of parallelism.
Oh,
so it's much faster to rebuild an index in lots of small chunks than one big, huge.
But again, this points to enough rows that effort makes sense.
Right. And, you know, hopefully, if you're doing anything interesting with your database, you have enough rows.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is interesting.
But that seems hard to justify lots of cores just for the frequency of index rebuilds.
So, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
It just depends on what you're doing. So memory has also become a lot cheaper.
Right. Well, my standard line went on stage is, how much memory does SQL Server want? More.
Yes. That's a good one.
There's no such thing as too much memory.
So I've seen databases with, servers with as much as 0.5 terabyte.
Wow.
Of RAM.
That's a lot of RAM.
Just one. It's one server with that much. But they are out there. And even more than that, from what I've heard. And I'm seeing pretty typically servers with 64 gigs, 128 gigs, you know, in that range.
Right.
That seems, you know, pretty typical. And at this point, even for a data warehouse, a lot of the hot data, the most commonly accessed data,
mm-hmm.
will fit in RAM.
Right. Yeah, if you've got 64 gigabytes of RAM, I mean, how big is your current working set for a relational cube? It may be 4 or 8 gigs, like the whole thing's going to fit in there.
Right. So that's where I/O becomes relatively unimportant at that point.
Right.
And now we just need to get that data processed in RAM as quickly as possible. Whether you're in an OLTP system or an OLAP system, more cores will work better. So on the OLTP side, more cores will give you more concurrency.
Right.
The ability for more people to make those small queries, even though they're not going parallel. You'll still be able to have more people doing those queries simultaneously. And then on the OLAP side, or, you know, data warehouse side, you'll be able to split up those queries better and have those queries return the data faster. And this can make a big difference where some people, you know, will have a query that's taking 10 minutes to run, pretty common in big data warehouses.
Right.
They have queries that take minutes rather than
mm-hmm.
milliseconds. And if you split those up across enough cores, we can get them down to, you know, seconds.
Have you ever had a sense of a good ratio of cores to memory, like a core for every gig or a core for every 2 gigs of RAM?
That is not something I've spent a lot of time thinking about, actually. Have you seen any rules on that?
I don't know any hard and fast rules, but I've noticed that, of course, it always depends on the workload. But often what would happen is it's very easy to cram a lot of RAM into a machine, but ultimately you couldn't utilize it because you simply ran out of cores. And if the ratio got much above 4 gigs to one core, you just never ate up the memory that well. And so I started playing with this idea of how much RAM do we really need. And then when you start looking at number of cores per chip, like if you're that 48-core chip, well, how the heck am I going to get enough RAM in that machine to take advantage of two of those?
I don't know if that algorithm really works for me.
I'm with you. It's not an easy one.
Well, I don't know if there's really that much of a correlation between the amount of RAM you need and the number of cores, or vice versa, for me. It seems like for most databases, there will be a hot set of data.
Right.
As we referred to earlier, that the most of the processes are using. And then there's kind of this long tail effect.
Right.
Where there's colder and colder and colder data, and some process out there is going to need, data that is from, 1965.
Yeah.
That no one else is using.
And it probably doesn't need to be cached.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be cached the first time, but it'll get cached as it's loaded in,
right,
by that process. So I don't see this correlation. So eventually that RAM is going to get used if your database is large enough.
Yeah. As long as your database is bigger than the amount of memory you've got, you're going to use up all the RAM. But I guess you get back to this idea of the hot set has got to be some fraction of the total memory.
Right.
And how can we act on that as quickly as possible? So how many cores does it make sense? I always looked at it on the OLTP side. I was never thinking parallelism. I was thinking, I don't want anybody's queries waiting. The number of simultaneous queries is not that high. So 8, 16, maybe 32 cores, and typically any query that's requested has a thread available to it.
Right, right. So,
but yeah, once you get into parallelism, this whole thing changes.
Yes, it absolutely does. And the number of worker threads is limited as well.
To how many?
So it's on SQL Server 2008, it is 512 for up to 8 cores.
Right.
And then 8, don't quote me on this.
Yeah.
But it's something around this. And then it's, I believe, 8 additional threads per core above 8 cores. And that's the default limit.
Okay. And you can adjust that number, obviously.
Yeah, that can be changed. There's a option you use, the sp configure command.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you configure all the server level options in SQL Server. And it's called max worker threads. And by default, it's 0. Generally, people want to leave that at 0 and let it be kind of automatically maintained.
Right.
But what will happen is, if you have heavy parallelism, you may hit a wait type called thread pool. And thread pool means you're out of worker threads.
In the default configuration.
Right. Well, in the default, or even if you mess with it yourself.
Right.
So, but if you run out of worker threads, that's generally a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It means that no one's doing any work.
It's not going to take on any more work until those threads finish.
Right. So that's a bad thing. And then there are other waits that can occur. As you increase the number of threads and go parallel, you use more memory in some cases. Because you need to keep all that data
right.
In different places.
Yeah.
And so then you can get into memory weights. And there's a weight you can see called resource semaphore. And that means you're out of workspace memory. So that's the memory that's used to do sorts and hashes and spools.
Okay.
And if you run out of that memory, that's a really bad thing.
Yeah, that's basically going to block all queries until stuff finishes.
Yes, that's correct.
So is a right number of threads per query where you're going to see the maximum benefit? I mean, we were turning this off back a few years ago because typically suddenly the query would try and run on 2 threads instead of 1, and it would run slower. And I'm wondering if there's a sort of diminishing return there where you need to split at least 4 times, but more than 8, and it's just not that much faster. Where's the big win?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's something I've been trying to find myself. And what I've found is it actually depends on the query.
Right.
Some queries that I've tested are great with 2 threads. Or maybe they're great with 1 thread.
Hmm.
You don't want any parallelism.
Yeah.
And then maybe they're faster with two.
So you do have some that benefit from just splitting the workload in half.
Oh, sure. Or even into three or four.
Right.
And then some of them will scale certain queries, like against really big sets of data with patterns where the data can be easily parallelized,
mm-hmm.
Can split up to 16 or 32 cores and still see great returns on doing that. Other queries will stop, and the way you figure this out is testing. And there's a query hint. It's called the MaxDOP hint, maximum degree of parallelism.
Okay.
It's MaxDOP.
Right.
And you can apply that at the query level. So you write your query, and then at the end you put option, paren, MaxDOP, and then a number, n paren. And basically that's how you test.
And what's the default MaxDOP?
Well, the default MaxDOP is whatever it's configured to at the server level.
Right.
So again, you use this spconfigure command, and it's max degree of parallelism, and it defaults to zero. When you install SQL Server. By the way, that's a terrible default.
Yeah, because it doesn't mean no threads.
No, that means unlimited.
Right.
You use as much parallelism as is available on the server.
Right.
And that's bad for concurrency. If you ever have more than one concurrent query, and you have, let's say you have two concurrent queries that are both really big.
Yeah.
And they both, the query processor decides in both cases, well, we'll just use all the cores.
Right.
Well, now you have thrashing, where these queries are competing with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of one of the problems with parallelism, is competition.
It does seem like there's a presumption there that parallelized queries represent only one query going on in the machine at a time, which just seems unrealistic.
Right, well, you know, it's a cooperative scheduling system in SQL Server.
Right.
So the goal is to let every query run with as much resources as it needs, and then when it's kind of finished, it'll turn over control of the next query.
Right.
And, you know, this is kind of a complex topic. And
yeah, because then there's the question is it more efficient for me to, I got eight cores, I've got two queries coming in, it's better for me to run one on eight and then the next one on eight, you know, waiting, or to do four on each?
Right. Well, that's not really how the scheduling system works.
Right.
So it's, it actually, there are penalties if the query stays on the scheduler for too long.
Yeah.
Things like that. So it's not pure cooperative scheduling, but it's very close. But anyway, getting back to the testing issue.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with zero. Well, that's when you install SQL Server, you have this max degree of parallelism of zero.
Right.
And for anyone listening who just installed SQL Server, go in and change that right now.
To what?
Actually, hit pause and go change it.
Yeah. We'll wait. we'll be here when you get back. But what are we going to set it to?
So for OLTP workloads, either way, for OLTP or OLAP workloads, you need to test.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way to figure out the right number for your workload. As I said, for every query, unfortunately, the number changes. And what you want to do is find a number that gives you the best possible performance and concurrency for your given workload.
What's the reasonable range? Is it like 1 to 16?
For OLTP, you want to approach 2, in my experience.
Right.
It used to be 1. We just wanted to turn it off for OLTP. But every OLTP system that I've seen recently seems to be trending toward mixed workload, which means you have a lot of OLTP queries, a lot of small, tiny queries.
Right.
And then you have a few big queries, like we want all the sales aggregated for the last year.
Right.
Kind of things. And people kind of use the OLTP system as a reporting system.
Yeah, I always pull off the data to a separate reporting system.
Well,
even if it's the same server, just a different instance.
That's a better practice, but not everyone does that.
Okay.
So, for those who aren't doing that.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that somebody goes and runs one of those analysis queries, it slows everybody else down.
Right. That's why you want to configure this MaxDOP setting. And that'll keep them from being able to do that.
Oh, I see. So, these big queries don't eat every possible thread.
Exactly. So I generally trend that towards 2. That's for MaxDOP on OLTP. The other reason you want to keep it above 1 is, again, for index rebuilds, things like that. You want to give those at least some room to parallelize.
Right.
So that's OLTP. On OLAP systems, I usually start with number of cores divided by 2.
Oh, interesting.
And then trend it from there, up or down, depending on what's going on. I generally wouldn't really want to go above that in most cases. Unless it's a system where there are very few concurrent queries.
Right.
And very big queries. So my thought on this is that number of cores divided by 2 will give you enough headroom that you could have two really, really big queries running at the same time and get both of them enough resources to finish in a reasonable amount of time and let other stuff run. Whereas if you go above that, now there's a chance that you could have competition between those big queries.
That makes sense, yeah.
So,
and typically, I find you have fewer OLAP queries running anyway. They tend to be big.
On most OLAP systems I see, yeah, you have maybe one or two or three running.
But I like this idea that if I do run in a mixed workload, that I can configure MaxStop in a way that stops those big queries from wiping out the OLTP queries.
Right. And then there's another key setting, which almost no one seems to mess with, but everyone should mess with it. And it's called the cost threshold for parallelism.
Okay.
And what this setting is, it's also a SPConfigure setting. And this setting actually determines if you look at a query plan, and if you hover, if you, let's say you're in the graphical query plan viewer, and you hover over the final iterator in the plan, which will usually be a select iterator, you'll see a cost of the entire query, query cost. And if that query cost exceeds the threshold set in the cost threshold for parallelism, then the query optimizer will try to find a parallel plan to use to satisfy that query.
Right. And then this is where in the old days, we'd see queries go over that threshold, suddenly become dramatically slower. So we'd bump that threshold up to avoid that problem.
Right. And that's still what you want to do.
Really?
So the default is 5. Now, today, a cost of 5 is nothing.
Yeah.
That's like, I mean, it's not the smallest query. So the smallest OLTP query will have a cost of 0.00 something.
Right.
And those won't go parallel. Yeah. So that's great. Cost of 5 is still pretty low. That means, you know, you're probably doing a couple of small range scans or something here and there, maybe a sort or two. And that's it. You're at 5.
Yeah.
So what I generally like to do is bump that way up to like 20. And most data warehouse queries I see have costs in the hundreds or even thousands.
Wow.
So if you have a mixed workload, this is really easy.
Yeah, this would be a great thing to run an analysis of a workload and just say, where does the strata of costs come in? I probably have a whole bunch of stuff that's like under 2, and then maybe a little gathering of them that are 2 to 10, and then hundreds.
Right. Yeah. And you can pull that out of the plan cache. Do that kind of analysis.
Cool.
The tricky part here is when your query goes parallel, it'll have a different cost. So if you're looking at a parallel query and you look at the cost, that has no bearing on why the parallel plan was considered. So in other words, the cost threshold operates on the serial plan, not the parallel plan.
Okay.
So to find out the cost of the original serial plan, you have to get it back to serial, and the way you do that, again, is with this max stop hint that I mentioned before.
So you force max stop at 1.
Exactly. So you have to take your parallel query, add the hint, see what the serial plan would be, and then that'll give you an idea of where it exceeded that threshold and what to put that threshold at.
What does the plan cost look like when you're parallel?
Well, the goal is to find a lower plan cost.
Right.
So the way the optimizer considers this is it starts with a serial plan. Well, it doesn't actually generate a plan. It generates a cost of what the plan would be.
Right.
And so it looks at, you know, what that cost would be. And if it exceeds the threshold, then it considers parallel plans. And if it finds a parallel plan with a lower cost, you know, it's all estimates.
Right. They are all estimates. And it is trying to factor in the breaking apart and the reassembly of the data.
Right. Yeah. But it's also taking into account, and the cost is supposed to be an indication of runtime.
Right. Yeah, that cost number, you don't want to call it seconds, but it's something like that.
Yeah, actually, in Books Online, they do call it seconds.
Yeah.
And the way
it's not right, but it definitely shows, you know, a cost of 10 versus a cost of 20. The 20 is probably going to run twice as long as the 10.
Well, my understanding, actually, of that cost, kind of an interesting story, is that during the SQL Server 7 development timeframe, they had some computer in the lab, in the QA lab.
Mm-hmm.
And that cost was how long queries took on that computer.
Interesting.
A given set of test queries. So it actually was seconds. But
on a piece of hardware now 10 years old.
which is somewhere in the Microsoft lab, which we don't have access to.
Right.
So it's kind of seconds.
Yeah, kind of.
But yeah, so basically that's the idea, is that it's duration of time.
Okay.
And so what that cost, the parallel cost, for example, it knows that scanning a table in parallel, let's say on 8 threads,
mm-hmm.
will take maybe not 1/8, but somewhat less time than scanning it in serial on 1 thread.
Right.
So the cost for that scan will be lower, even though, interestingly, the resource utilization is much higher.
Right.
So that's how those kind of work.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, it, you know, we've been sort of using the concept of a core and a thread interchangeably, but you run many threads per core anyway, because typically they're waiting for other things than just processing time, right? A given thread could then need to do some I/O or go fetch something, so another thread could be running through a given core. Like this is not a simple set of numbers.
Right, right. And that's actually how the cooperative scheduling system works.
Right.
In SQL servers, it's based on the idea that threads will... So basically, one thread can be active on a scheduler at a given time.
Right.
And SQL Server has as many schedulers as there are physical CPUs bound to the instance.
Right.
So if you have four cores bound to your SQL Server instance, you'll have four schedulers. But of course, you can have up to 512 threads active.
On a given core.
But only one thread can be actively using a scheduler at any given time.
Right.
And the idea is that threads will go on the scheduler, then they'll have to wait for something like I/O
right.
or memory or whatever. And so they'll have to come off the scheduler, do that wait, and meanwhile some other thread will come on.
Jump in place.
And do the thing. And so what will happen is if a thread starts monopolizing the scheduler, it will get kind of forced to yield.
Right.
By the scheduling system.
It's not always going. Basically, this thread is not working and playing well with others.
Right. So it's cooperative until it's not quite as cooperative.
So. You're not cooperating well enough. You go sit in the corner.
Exactly. So, and that's called a, in case you're looking at weights and queues, that's called an SOS scheduler yield weight.
Interesting. So the first question that people run into is sometimes this query runs fast, sometimes it's running slow. Could it be that it's parallelizing it and that's either make it faster or slower? So what are the best ways to determine what's happening with a query?
In terms of...
out in the wild. Do I fire on SQL Profiler and pull them out, or is it better ways to get at that information?
Yeah, I don't really use Profiler too often these days.
Oh, really?
I use the DMVs
okay.
more often than not. And
because they know they're picking the live data.
Right, exactly. So with the DMVs, you can actually look and see what is running right now, and you can see what those queries are waiting on.
Right.
And if you have a query that's gone parallel, it can actually have multiple waits, because, again, each of the threads
right.
running can have its own wait state.
Sure.
So... the way that you look at this is there's a DMV called sysdmos waiting tasks. And that DMV relates back to the requests and sessions DMV. And the requests and sessions DMVs have, the request DMV has a SQL handle. And you take that thing and you can go out to the query text DMV and figure out what the text is. Or you can download a script that does all the work for you.
Nice.
Which is what I recommend. And to download such a script, you could go to tinyurl.com/whoisactive. That's just one word. And download the script that I wrote.
Who is active? Just checking it out, making sure it works.
So tinyurl.com/whoisactive.
There it is. Oh, and this is off your blog.
Yes.
There you go.
So in that script will tell you for all of the active queries currently running on the system, it'll give you all the information you could possibly want about the query in terms of what it's doing, how many threads it's spun up, what they're waiting on. It'll tell you what locks have been taken if you want. It'll give you the query plan, all
nice.
Kinds of stuff. So give that a try. And if that doesn't work, or if that doesn't give you enough information, the next step is to go for extended events. And that is a SQL Server 2008 enhancement,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a new tracing system.
Nice.
It's been added in 2008, and it's quite complex. not something that you really want to.
Go there if you really, really have to.
You go there if you have to, but there's a report that you can download from CodePlex.
Oh yeah.
And I'm trying to remember the name. It was put out by the SQL Cat team, and that's the customer advisory team. And this is a team that's tasked with helping kind of the highest end SQL Server customers to achieve really good performance and scale using SQL Server. And they developed this report on CodePlex, and it's called, I don't know, the Extended Events Weights Report or something like that. I apologize for not remembering the name. But you take this report and you point it at your SQL Server instance, and what it'll do is use extended events, and it can collect for every query that's running all of the weights that occur over the lifetime of the query. So you start up a query, the query finishes 15 seconds later. During that time, it could have gone in and out of wait states 10,000 times.
Right.
There's no way you can capture that with the DMVs.
Yes,
you'd have to
too fast.
Collect every 4 milliseconds.
Oh, I think I found it. It's the SQL Server 2008 Extended Events SSMS add-in.
No, that's different.
Is that different? Oh.
That's different. That's a plugin to help people write their own extended events collections, which is also a good thing. But the one I'm thinking of is, I don't know, if you go to sqlcat.com and search around, you can find it.
Right.
But anyway, it'll go out and it'll collect all the weights that the query does while it's running, and then it'll aggregate them and it does a nice little reporting services report.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, sqlcat.codeplex.com has a few different projects in it, including the extended events response time analysis.
That's it.
There you go.
So, and the idea is, for a given query, if you're tuning a query, what you care about at the end of the day is the response time.
Yeah.
And the response time of a given query is equal to the amount of time it spent waiting plus the CPU time.
Yep.
That it consumed. So, you take all the weights, you aggregate them, the rest of the time is CPU time. You assume, for better or for worse, that you can't probably do too much with the CPU time, but your goal is to eliminate those weights
sure.
as much as possible.
Adam, this is awesome. It's exactly what I was hoping you could talk to us about. It's nice to get me up to date on what's going on in here. Any other key bits we're missing, problems you're going to encounter, things like that?
Well, there's lots of key bits, unfortunately. So this stuff gets pretty complex. It's actually, I found extremely interesting. It's kind of simple on the surface.
Right.
And then as you dig, you can get kind of deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, I guess in practice here, this is something that happens simultaneously, many connections, like it's a complex thing. The tests you do are never going to be as complicated as the reality.
Right. So, just keep studying.
Yeah.
And check out my blog, sqlblog.com. I actually have a blog series on parallelism and how to read parallel query plans.
Nice.
If you get into parallelism, you're going to want to start actually learning to understand what your queries are doing so you can tune them. And if you don't mind a quick advertisement.
Hit me.
I am doing a full-day seminar at the PASS conference.
In November.
In November. It's a post-conference seminar,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be a full day on parallelism and related topics.
Awesome. Are you bringing out enough hardware to actually run some parallel queries for folks?
I just bought a new Lenovo W510 laptop, which has 4 hyper-threaded cores.
Nice.
And 16 gigs of RAM.
And hyper-threading creates another set of issues there, because they're dual-core, sort of. It's like a core and a slightly brain-damaged cousin sitting beside it.
Yeah, it's kind of sort of. So that's actually something else that I'm working on right now is running tests against both my laptop and some actual customer servers.
Right.
To find out what the impact is of hyperthreading.
Yeah.
With the new generation of hyperthreading. We know that the old generation was bad.
Well, had some issues.
So we would turn that off. But the new one, there's mixed reports.
And it's got more to do with how well the SQL team is actually tweaked and tuned, because you can hint as to whether this particular process can run on that secondary core or not. So hopefully they've actually got that all worked out.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm going to withhold a comment on that.
You're collecting data as we speak.
So, actually, literally. So,
Adam Mechanic, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.